From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Jennifer Mitchell with the news on this day in Maine, Friday, September 17th, 2021.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by the Maine law firm of Eaton Peabody, serving generations of Maine families and businesses from offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
The number of COVID-19 cases detected in Maine continued its steep climb today. The state CDC reported another 715 coronavirus infections today. The seven-day average of new cases now stands at 485, the highest point since January. Two more people with COVID-19 have died. They were a man and a woman, one in their 60s, the other over age 80. One was from Androscoggin County. The other was a resident of Waldo County. 201 patients are in the hospital with COVID-19 as of this afternoon. 76 are in critical care and 34 are in ventilators. The Maine Supreme Court is temporarily barring construction on a disputed mile-long section of Central Maine Power's controversial transmission line project through western Maine. The High Court order is in effect while justices consider CMP's appeal of a lower court decision, which reversed approval on a state lease for the lands in question. CMP is calling the latest ruling a win. In a press statement, the company says it means that work will be allowed to continue on the rest of the 141-mile corridor project in the meantime. The Maine Department of Labor says many local and state government employees must be vaccinated or tested weekly under a new plan announced by the Biden administration. Last week, the administration directed the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration to mandate that all employers with at least 100 employees require their workers to be vaccinated or provide a negative COVID-19 test each week. According to the Maine Department of Labor, the federal government has informed the state that the mandate will apply to all employees of Maine's state, county, and local governments and public school systems as well with 100 or more employees. That includes the state's university and community college systems as well as the Maine Turnpike Authority. The time frame for when employees will be required to get those vaccines, however, still remains uncertain. Well, the jobs picture held pretty steady in Maine through the summer. The state's unemployment rate held at 4.9% last month. The Maine Department of Labor says the number of non-farm payroll jobs fell by 1,200 to 617,200 in August. But over the course of the year, the number of payroll jobs increased by 31,500. The number of jobs total is more than 22,000 less, however, than in February 2020, just before the pandemic hit. Unemployed workers in Maine say the risk of COVID-19 exposure and a lack of job opportunities are still keeping many from returning to the workforce. That's according to the results of a survey released by the Maine Department of Labor. More than a third of respondents said few job opportunities were available that matched their skill sets. Childcare, transportation, and low wages and benefits were also found to be significant barriers. Andy O'Brien with the Maine AFL-CIO says that largely echoes what his organization is hearing from unemployed Mainers. He's hoping that a new unemployment navigator system established in recent legislation will make it easier for Mainers to find and apply to long-term positions.
To help people get into quality jobs, union apprenticeships, and jobs that pay living wages.
The Maine Department of Labor says it's working with other agencies to address those barriers and says the Mills administration has recently made substantial investments in areas such as affordable housing and child care. The Maine League of Women Voters is criticizing the state Senate maps that were released by the Apportionment Committee yesterday. The group writes in a statement that the maps that were shared with the public lack the information and detail needed for people to be able to weigh in. Executive Director Anna Keller points to municipalities such as Portland and Scarborough as examples where district splits are proposed, but says it's impossible for voters to tell which district they'd be in. The Apportionment Committee plans to meet again and hold a public hearing on Monday. The commission faces a deadline of September 27th to have new voting district maps drawn up to satisfy changing population data from the last census and submitted to the Maine legislature. Maine Attorney General Aaron Fry is filing civil rights charges against two teenagers in Bangor. The complaint alleges that the two teens, both age 15, spray-painted racial epithets and threats on a vehicle belonging to Tamor Khan of Bangor. Fry says in a statement that the, quote, egregious racist messages on the vehicle victimized not only the property owner, but all people of color, end quote. The complaint was filed in Penobscot County Superior Court. The teens are ordered not to have further contact with Khan and to avoid violating the Maine Civil Rights Act in the future. Violation of the act is punishable by almost a year in jail and a $2,000 fine. The Maine Department of Corrections announced today that it will conduct a comprehensive review of the Long Creek Youth Development Center in partnership with a national juvenile justice advocacy group. As Susan Sharon reports, the review is one of several steps the DOC says it will take after a series of violent incidents at the facility last month.
The incidents, which occurred five times between August 2nd and September 13th, involved residents throwing furniture into windows, breaking furniture apart to use as weapons, assaulting other residents and staff, and flooding the residence hall, which resulted in more than $100,000 in damage. Corrections Commissioner Randy Liberty says they occurred at a time when Long Creek saw a doubling of residents to 41 and a significant increase in those considered high risk.
80% of the residents that are at Long Creek there are high risk. They're there for things such as arson, gross sexual assault, robbery, aggravated assault with a weapon, those sorts of things. And they have acuity levels that are more likely to be aggressive.
Liberty says staff are usually successful at using de-escalation techniques. But if those don't work, he says restraining residents becomes necessary to take back control. In at least one instance, Liberty says a prone restraint was used to subdue a resident. The controversial and dangerous tactic involves putting youth on their stomachs in a prone position and applying pressure to their backs, which can cause asphyxiation. That use of force is now the subject of an investigation.
They're being reviewed by the district attorney's office to determine appropriateness or not.
Meanwhile, top administrators of Long Creek have resigned, and the department says it will review the facility's practices in partnership with the Center for Children's Law and Policy, a national public interest organization focused on juvenile justice reform. In an assessment of the facility 4 years ago, the center had flagged prone restraints as something that should be avoided because of residents' history of trauma and mental health needs.
Maybe a word I would use would be stunned.
Democratic Representative Charlotte Warren of Hollowell is co-chair of the legislature's Criminal Justice Committee, which oversees the Department of Corrections. She says she doesn't understand why the state would pay for another report from the Center for Children's Law and Policy after one was done in 2017 and another more recently in February 2020.
And on page 136, they say that one of the long-term goals should be, and I quote, achieve removal of all youth from Long Creek, unquote. We've paid for these reports. We have the data, and we're going to do it again.
Warren and other lawmakers say the recent violence is another reason why Long Creek should close. That view is shared by the ACLU of Maine and the group Maine Youth Justice, led by formerly incarcerated young adults. A bill to close the facility was recently vetoed by Governor Janet Mills. Governor Mills spokesperson Lindsey Cree released a statement saying that the Mills administration is implementing juvenile justice reforms signed into law earlier this year. They include identifying community-based secure residences to reduce the use of institutional confinement. But Crete says the Department of Corrections must protect public safety by accepting residents a judge has deemed cannot be placed anywhere else. Commissioner Liberty says closing the facility to high-risk residents would be premature.
Where would we place them? We can either do this work, we can do it well, or we can do it quickly. And if you do this work quickly, you don't do it well.
Liberty says the department plans to modify housing units and pursue design changes to improve Long Creek's environment and to add more behavioral health clinicians. The DOC already spends more than $18 million a year on Long Creek, and Charlotte Warren says she doesn't understand why the department would spend more when the goal is to develop community placements. Warren says her committee intends to hold a public hearing on the recent events at Long Creek, and the commissioner will be invited to attend. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
You're listening to This Day in Maine. Still ahead, of course, we'll have the latest weather forecast for you and Maine's Political Pulse. time once again for Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Jennifer Mitchell, sitting in this week for host Erwin Gratz. And of course, State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler is here. He's been keeping an eye on the recall election of California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. So Steve, Governor Newsom easily beat back a Republican-led effort to oust him. And you're suggesting in your newsletter this week that his victory could have some implications for Maine's gubernatorial race next year. So what factors are at play here that you're seeing?
And I think the California recall is interesting, not in terms of how it might foreshadow the result of the Maine race next year, but more importantly, how the pandemic might factor into the race. So what we're discussing now might have a little bit of a shelf life, but as it stands, the pandemic is a key issue for voters. And the California recall was essentially a referendum on Governor Newsom's pandemic response. And it's basically a stand-in for many Democratic governors' responses, including Governor Janet Mills's. I mean, there's some, you know, subtle differences in terms of restrictions and mask mandates and that sort of thing, but it's the same approach. But in that race, Republicans really overestimated how angry voters were about Newsom's business restrictions, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, you name it. Well, they were really wrong about that. So wrong that Newsom made his response front and center and made California voters, you know, imagine living in a pandemic under the governorship of Larry Elder, who was the leading Republican candidate to replace him. And Newsom, you know, he just crushed it. So I think Mills might have something to run on here, especially if she can somehow make voters imagine a pandemic under former Governor Paula Page, who's going to be her opponent. That doesn't necessarily mean that she'll cruise to a second term, though. I mean, California's electorate is just fundamentally different than Maine's. I think a more comparable one is Virginia, which is purplish and skewing Democrat as a result of the Trump presidency. So that race is on the ballot this year, and it's really, really close. I suspect that contest will be a better indicator of the trajectory of the Maine race. But if the pandemic is a leading issue next year, what we saw in California this week could be really informative.
You invoked the name of our former governor, Paul LePage, there, and he's planning to make his 2022 run for the Blaine House official next week with a rally at the Augusta Civic Center. Now, he did already formally announce his decision, and he'd been saying, of course, that he was going to run for an unprecedented third term even before Governor Mills was elected. The two are longtime adversaries. Now, how do you see this race shaping up in the next few months, especially given that Mills has yet to actually announce her intention to reseek the seat?
Well, first of all, it's just going to be really, really expensive and just ridiculously. One ad analyst projected $75 million in spending for this contest, which is more than triple what it was in the 2018 gubernatorial race. You know, that's well short of last year's U.S. Senate race, which was around $200 million, but it's still plenty of money to saturate, you know, television, radio, and digital spaces with just nonstop ads, which will probably do more to persuade people that our campaign finance system is busted than it will to influence voters. But in terms of issues, I think, again, the big one will be the pandemic, at least in the early stages of the race. And on that, I think, you know, Governor Mills might have the advantage unless there's some, you know, cataclysmic shakeup. But on vaccines, LePage has basically taken the position of a lot of GOP governors, which is that he recommends the vaccines, but not mandates. It's basically a personal freedom argument that's perhaps best exemplified by Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. But just this week, DeSantis found out that ground between pro-vaccine and pro-personal freedom is pretty shaky because of this encroachment of the anti-vax disinformation that's just seemingly everywhere. He had this press conference featuring this worker aggrieved over vaccine mandates. And then the worker just started parroting, you know, anti-vax talking points. You know, it was basically the same misinformation you could find on Fox News, conservative radio stations, or these Facebook memes that have become sort of this mirage of informational clarity for real or self-imposed news deserts. And we've seen this in Maine too, at some of these rallies that purport to be about personal freedom, but end up veering into anti-vax conspiracy. So that's just one issue that I think the former Governor LePage is going to have to deal with. There's going to be plenty of others that will define the race. The economy will be a big one. And, you know, right now, the recovery that Mills and other Democrats want to run on is okay. but kind of under threat because of this rampaging of the Delta variant. And of course, there's going to be other issues. You know, abortion is going to be a big one, especially in light of this Texas law that effectively bans the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy. You know, Mills is already fundraising off of that. She's been actually been pretty quiet lately publicly. And, you know, her once seemingly, you know, imminent announcement that she's running for re-election has been pushed off for a bit. But I don't expect LePage to come meandering out of the gate after Wednesday. So the governor might be inclined to wait, but it's possible the ferocity of the early campaign may not accommodate her schedule.
If history is any indication, LePage actually comes in as maybe a bit of an underdog this time. Elections usually favor incumbents. He's also going to have to walk a bit of a fine line for his adoration of former President Donald Trump and related events like the January 6th insurrection. Have there been any early signs about how LePage plans to create a little distance maybe, or is that even what he wants to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the only signal we're getting is this sort of nebulous chatter that LePage has somehow changed, you know, become more mellow and policy focused. That's the spin from his allies. The problem with that, I think, is twofold. One, it's really hard to imagine LePage being any different than he was just a few months ago, and certainly during his two terms in office, which spanned 8 years. Those were pretty jarring in terms of his conduct and just how disruptive it was here in Augusta, not to mention subversive to his stated goal for wanting the job, which is governing. The other problem, I think, is that a lot of LePage voters liked that he was pugnacious because in their mind, he was fighting for them. So, you know, they could sort of excuse the language and behavior for that reason. In terms of Trump, I mean, look, the guy still has a grip on the Republican Party. You know, overwhelming majorities of GOP voters believe this, you know, fantasy that the election was stolen from him. So I don't think LePage can distance himself too much from Trump. You know, LePage has said himself that he was Trump before Trump was popular. And he was, you know, he had the same kind of hold on GOP voters, acted very similar. His two terms in office were as chaotic and just nonstop drama. So if there's going to be any distance between LePage and Trump, I think it might be end up being kind of superficial. And it could be as simple as tailoring his message to different audiences, you know, just, you know, in big public events covered by the press, he might not mention the former president, but in private GOP meetings or whatever, he might go for the full embrace. You know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler with Maine's Political Pulse. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to Steve's newsletter if you've not already done so, and you can check out a full-length version of the podcast at mainepublic.org. That's mainepublic.org, or of course, subscribe wherever you like to get your podcasts. I'm Jennifer Mitchell sitting in for Erwin Gratz, and he should be back with us next week. And it's time now to check the weather forecast with meteorologist Paul Cousins.
Moisture is building, and that will arrive in the form of low clouds along the coastline pressing inland. Late at night, some patchy drizzle as well, with some areas of dense fog. Throughout central and northern Maine, the overcast will gradually tighten up. Temperatures quite uniform overnight, 55 to 60. Location, 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 and time of day. That will dictate what you're viewing Saturday as a front bears down on Maine. Across northern Maine and the mountains, mostly cloudy with showers and afternoon thunderstorms. Down east, foggy and cloudy all day, perhaps some showers late. Throughout central and southern Maine, with some luck, be patient. Fog will melt away with partial afternoon sunshine, showers and thunder late, and it will become quite humid, 69 to 79 north to south. Sunday, expect only a few thin, wispy filaments aloft. Plenty of sun, much drier behind the front. 64 to 75 north to south. Monday and Tuesday, like summer. Mostly sunny statewide. 70s for most. Might even clip 80 throughout interior Cumberland and York counties on Tuesday. 60s along the coast east of Freeport. And showers will arrive at some point Wednesday. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up in the next Maine Calling Monday at 11 a.m., a discussion on fetal alcohol syndrome. I'm Jennifer Mitchell. Thanks for listening.